702.
The Big Interview
with Bongani Bengwa.
Exactly 16 minutes after 7 o'clock. It's the economy, stupid, right? President Cyril Ramaphosa recently told the World Economic Forum's virtual Davos meeting that we intend to focus on building infrastructure. He says we're going to expand our energy generation capacity. We're going to do so rapidly. We're going to create jobs. We've got an employment stimulus package that's on the way. We're going to intensify our drive for an export-oriented industrial development economy. Yet despite all these assurances, the International Monetary Fund says all our growth projections at this stage are optimistic. So what can we as a country learn, particularly from those who have done this kind of rapid growth split before, from those giants that have reawakened? I'm pleased to tell you that we're joined now by Dr. Montek Singh Ahluwalia, who's the former deputy chairperson of the Planning Commission of India, who joins us now on the line. A very good morning to you, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on your show.
In 2013, The Economist argued that BRICS should actually be spelt with capital B-R-I-C and the S should be a small letter. How does South Africa turn our small S into a big one?
Well, I wouldn't pretend to know how to advise another country. I think the whole issue of what we need to do to accelerate our growth, which is the only way that we can become bigger letters, is there's some general truths and there are some things that are very country specific. You know, I think the general truths, which I think in India we have certainly found very important, you really cannot grow if you cannot have a high rate of investment. And I think that in our case, we tried very hard with some success to raising the rate of investment. In the old days, people used to hoping to raise the rate of investment would count on public investment to do this. I think over a couple of decades and more, people have realized that actually the real, the search for efficiency and economic dynamism depends on being able to raise private investment, both by the bigger corporations, but also by smaller companies, individual firms, etc. So I think that, you know, I don't believe there's a lot of talk about economic reforms, all of which is very important.
Yeah.
But in the end, if investment rates do not rise, it's very difficult to raise the growth rate. Now, we were able to raise the investment rate in India sometime in the around 2009-10 to something of the order of 34%. Which is a big increase from what it was earlier, which was in the kind of late 20s. And I think that has come down after the financial crisis, and of course in the present situation of COVID, it's come down further. I'm sure that South Africa has the same problem with declining investment levels, but you know, the overall levels of investment in South Africa, from what I remember, have been relatively modest, sort of more in the order of 13, 14, 15%, that kind of thing. And I think, you know, if you really want to grow, South Africa needs to aim at jacking up the investment rate by at least 7 or 8% of GDP, a lot of it coming from the private sector, but of course the public sector has a big role to play in building the infrastructure.
Let me come in. If we talk about liftoff in terms of your learnings in India, 1991 is perhaps the year we can go back to. The geopolitical order was changing. Technology in the 90s grew in unprecedented ways. As you say, right now we're in the middle of a global pandemic. It's a storm unlike any other in living memory. How do you grow investment in that environment when really the whole world is struggling and fighting for the same thing?
No, it's a big problem right now because I think we're just beginning to see a kind of return to normalcy, and that's very far from achieved, and there's lots of uncertainty. We don't know about second spikes in the infection. We don't know how effective vaccination will be, and it's over the next year that that will become clearer. It's also true, compared to, say, the 90s or even the early 2000s, that the global environment has become much less supportive of a multilateral commitment to globalization. So the bigger, the more advanced countries are raising protectionist barriers, not against all developing countries, but against those that challenge them, especially China. So I think the external world that we all face today is less open. It's also, I think, more uncertain. And the change in technology is introducing altogether new challenges in terms of what it's going to do to employment. And that's something we cannot actually avoid, because we cannot say this is for the developed countries. I mean, if we want to be in part of the global world, and I do believe that that has to remain the objective. I mean, even though the external environment has changed, the compulsion, the logic is that for growing countries to become part of the global world and try to move the rules a little bit more in our favor. But that does mean that some of the new technologies will inevitably percolate down to us with lots of advantages. I mean, digitalization is a very good example of something that has huge potential for developing countries. But it will alter the structure of the economy, and it could alter the nature of employment. What that does to the private sector is very difficult to anticipate. I mean, one can imagine a situation in which changes in technology, changes in the global environment, uncertainties about global rules, cause private investors to just hold back and wait a little bit before they commit themselves. Well, the only thing governments can do is to reassure them that government policy will remain pro-private investment, supportive of new investors, both domestic and, I would say, foreign. And that's the best we can do. But, you know, certainly in India, we're trying to avoid a situation where the change in the global environment leads people to say, forget about the global trade, let's just concentrate on ourselves, we're a big enough market. I think that would be quite wrong. I mean, the government is not saying that. The government is saying we want to be part of the global supply chain. But you can see some businesses sort of falling back into older protectionist arguments because they see the big boys doing exactly that. So I think the in these matters, international trends do get transmitted. And so I think policymakers have a difficult balancing job. But they have to be very clear in their own minds that, you know, we do need to remain open, we do need to integrate with the world, but the way we do things and the kind of rules we want will be somewhat different from what they were like 10 or 15 years ago.
All right. So one of the things you talk about is not being in favor of big bang reforms. You talk about gradualism, but many economies, certainly South Africa's, have pressing needs that need to be addressed urgently. How do we factor a concept like gradualism, where things are changed over a period of time in a kind of phased transition, when we've got urgent and pressing matters to address right now?
Well, I think this is, again, this is more a matter of, if you like, balance and sequencing. In the 1991 reforms, we took on a whole number of constraints that urgently needed to be removed, and then we removed them. But then a lot of people said, look, the logic of what you're doing requires you to do A, B, C, and D as a sort of logical next step, and you should bundle it all together into one big bang reform. That's what we didn't do. I mean, I'm not saying that everything must be done gradually. I think rather one has to look at any given time. You know, India's still in the lower end of the middle income group. You in South Africa are higher up in that range, but we're all developing countries and we're very far from where our potential is. Therefore, the number of reforms we have to do is enormous. I mean, it includes institutional reforms, legal reforms, all kinds of reforms. I think what we need at any given stage is to identify what are the critical reforms with the biggest bang for the buck in the next 2 or 3 years and get those done. But at the same time, it's not good enough to say, okay, we've now done the reforms and we have nothing else to do. The fact is there will be new reforms that come in. As you remove certain constraints on an economy and it bounces forward, it hits other constraints. And removing those constraints requires a broader set of reforms, and you have to take those on. Now, one of the problems is that, you know, when you're in the middle of a crisis and certain things are seen as being critical constraints, it may be easier politically to take those on and get rid of them. If you define a very huge agenda of change, it may not be easy to get it done because it creates too much uncertainty in too many minds. So what I'm saying is that we have to accept that it's not much use making a list of all the reforms we have to do. I think we should certainly be aware of them. We should identify the ones that are most important right now and get those out of the way. But also keep in mind that having got them out of the way, there's a second stage, the next batch of reforms that you should identify and prepare the people for and create a political environment where you are ready to move on to those. The problem is there's reform fatigue. I mean, people are willing, in the middle of a crisis, they're willing to take on one batch of reforms, but later on, as soon as the crisis eases, all the sort of resistance is coming. And that's really the role, in my view, of political leadership. Somehow the political leadership has to take credit for what it's been able to achieve, but also tell the public that there's a hell of a long way to go, and somehow keep that on the agenda.
All right, we'll leave it there. Dr. Montek Singh Ahluwalia, thank you so much for your time. The former deputy chairperson of the Planning Commission of India. He was also, of course, the youngest division chief at the World Bank when he was just 28 years old.